From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the cowboy and the cattle drive.
Kansas cattle towns were pretty good at relieving of them of their money on the dance floor or the gambling table or somehow.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
Boys, I was born in the Texas state many years ago. I've rode on every range and a plain, there's no place I don't know. I love to swing the lariat, that's all I'll ever do. I'm a rootin' singin' cowboy and I've never had the blues. For I hop on my old pinto and o'er the plains we ride. Just swingin' in the saddle, my guitar hangs by my side. Old Pinto's always willing, as for me I'm never sad. You'll find there beats an honest heart in this old Texas land. Oh, lady, oh, lady, lady, oh, lady, oh, lady, oh, lady, oh, lady, oh, lady, oh, lady, lady, oh, lady, oh, lady.
The cowboy is a figure in American mythos born out of the great cattle drives. But it's the popular culture cowboy that outshines the real trail poke. Tim Lehman, professor of history at Rocky Mountain College, writes about it in his new book, Up the Trail, How Texas Cowboys Herded Longhorns and Became an American Icon.
The cowboys were, the term boys is somewhat appropriate because they were often very young. Now I'm talking here of the cowboys who went up the trail, as they say, took the longhorns to Kansas and beyond to the northern ranges. And they were often very young, the children of farmers who were temporarily unemployed or out of work right after the Civil War, as well as sometimes Mexican-Americans and African-Americans who were economically marginalized at the time. So this was a job for people who didn't have a lot of other opportunities.
So when you say young, how young?
There are some accounts as young as 12 years old.
The typical age would be about what?
Probably late teens.
And when you say African-American, Mexican-American, we're talking about vaqueros and former slaves?
Yes. Both of whom typically brought more skills with and experience working with cattle, but could simultaneously be paid less because of the racial hierarchies. It was a hard job. It was a job with low pay. On the cattle trail, these cattle herders would work 16 to 20 hours a day for months on end, and so there wasn't a lot to... There wasn't a lot of romance in it at the time.
How many cowboys were typically on a trail working a herd?
So herds would number perhaps several thousand, 2,000 to 3,000, and that might take about 12 cowboys, a trail boss, and then the riders, and they would all ride in a kind of hierarchy all the way to the tail, the drag, who had the worst and were usually the youngest of the lot.
They'd have to eat all the dust.
Exactly.
So they all had jobs to do, kind of like if a position's on a hockey team.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. They had very specific jobs, places to be, and they could communicate with hand signals usually about whether they needed to bunch the herd tighter or stretch it out or speed it up or slow it down. But a very clear hierarchy on the trail.
And when there was also the chuck wagon.
The chuck wagon was the sort of center of camp life because of the food, but also it would store any extra gear that the cattle herders had.
So how many horses would a cowboy bring with him on a ride like that?
That's a great question. A cowboy who brought his own horse or horses might command a little bit more money. Not all of them did. They would typically use three or four at least, and as many as eight or ten because of the long hours in the saddle. And so that meant that a herd might have 50 or more traveling in the remuda.
So a cowboy would switch out horses several times a day?
Several times a day, and then again at night if he was on the night shift.
So how did you sign up for one of these things?
you got to know the right person, probably one of the leading ranchers in the area. Sometimes you'd get recruited. There's some number of people who saw it as some romance and freedom and ran away from home to do it. All kinds of ways.
You had to have some level of skill. I mean, this was a major investment that they were moving up from Texas to Kansas, and this wasn't going to be amateur hour.
Right. So there's a lot of skill, especially with the trail boss and the lead hands. A lot less skill required to sort of sit in a saddle and eat dust and just encourage the stragglers to keep moving. And so for some people, this may have been their first experience on horseback.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopie tie, I oh, rocking to and fro. Back in the saddle again. Whoopie tie, I go my way. Back in the saddle again.
How much they get paid?
Newcomers, $20 to $30 a month. More skilled hands, especially if they brought their own horses, might be $40 or $50 a month. A top hand, maybe $70 or more. But that would be fairly rare.
And what would that compare to their lifelong earnings?
This would be, for most cattle workers, not a major source of income. This is at a time when a lot of workers in industrial America could make a dollar a day more if they were skilled. So this is not great pay.
So the myth of the cowboy is that you would go on one of these adventures, become on a trail ride, and that you would make enough money to make a stake, and then maybe you would come back to your home part of Texas and buy your own little ranch. That didn't happen.
Not very often. That's not to say it didn't happen, because it did, especially for those people who were able to round up a few cattle of their own. So there are people who started out like this and became successful ranchers and bankers and so on, but that was rare.
Those are the people at the top of the food chain.
Yes.
Not the lowly swing man on the herd.
Exactly. The swing man probably got to Kansas, took his wages, went to the barber shop, got a haircut and a shave, spent some money on food, a new outfit, and then went to the saloon, and by the time he was done, there was nothing left.
Well, that kind of matches up with part of the myth, the Gunsmoke story that you might see in an episode.
Yeah, the myth probably owes a lot to its origins in the cattle towns, which is, a very special moment at the end of the trail, when everyone's on kind of a spree, this glorious celebration, and they have money in their pockets, but they tended not to leave Kansas with very much money. The Kansas cattle towns were pretty good at relieving them of their money on the dance floor or the gambling table or somehow.
Keep rolling, 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 though the streams are swollen. Keep them doggies rolling, right through wishing my girl was by my side. All the things I'm missing, good fiddles, love and kissing, are waiting at the end of my ride. Move 'em on, hit 'em up, hit 'em up, move 'em on, hit 'em up, raw hide. Cut 'em out, ride 'em in, ride 'em in, let 'em out, cut 'em out, ride 'em in, raw.
The cowboys were a part of a economic system, moving cattle from Texas to Kansas, where that beef was sent to New York City for consumption. That was a major economic enterprise.
Absolutely. This is one of the sort of late 19th century economic boom, if you will. People called it the cattle bonanza. It could bust just as well as it could boom, but it did make a lot of money and bring a lot of money home to Texas. Again, not so much in the pockets of workers, but in the wallets of the cattle owners.
Before the cattle drives, were people eating beef?
The mid-19th century is right at the sort of swing point when Americans were changing their preferences from pork to beef. Beef had this reputation of being more respectable and solidly middle class, and health experts of the day warned that pork was bad for you and beef was the best thing going. It's kind of interesting compared to how different that is today, but beef was supposed to be the health food of the day, and all of that meant there was a pretty good market for beef. Now, the problem that the Texans had was that Longhorn cattle were not very beefy. They were great on the trail because of their long legs and rangy bodies, but that made them kind of stringy as beef went. So they typically had to be fattened up for a season or even two or three seasons, and that made them more palatable for the beef for the table.
It's interesting how there was this eventual development of the cattle industry and how there were pioneers in the business world, in the pioneering world, who made that happen. I mean, who were some of the leaders?
Some of the leaders have come down to us as famous. Charles Goodnight is perhaps the best known, and he was an expert at driving these cattle, probably the best in the business. Ike Pryor was very successful. The Goodnight Loving Trail went through West Texas and over to New Mexico and then up to Colorado. So his trail was farther west and tougher, harder because of all the dry country that it had to go through.
So what's the significance of having one of these trails, like the Chisholm Trail or the Goodnight Trail?
The Chisholm Trail, for instance, was publicized by the railroad company. They had a pamphlet that told everyone where the best places to stop, where the best places to grass their herd, to water their herd, and taking them directly to the cattle market in Abilene first and later at the other Kansas towns. And that was to ensure that the railroad got the cattle business. So the trails were pointing directly to the market, as it were.
And so there was essentially some sort of infrastructure in place, places to water the cattle. We knew, and agreements with the native people with their lands in order to pass through.
Sometimes some conflict as they went through Indian territory, as it was then, because the herds would slow down and sort of eat extra grass, and so the Cherokee, the Creeks, the Muscogees, the Chickasaw passed laws requiring a certain fee, usually one or several of the cattle, and that was a source of some conflict, but not the kind of armed violence that we sometimes think of.
They would pay to bring the cattle through.
They would pay to bring the cattle through, and many of the drivers were absolutely happy to pay that fee and maintain the peace, and they drove through on these fairly well-established trails.
What was the reasoning behind the cattle drive? How much more could a cow be worth in Abilene than it would be in San Antonio?
The famous phrase here from Texas historian Walter Prescott Webb is to connect the $4 cow with the $40 market. Cattle in Texas in the brush country might be as little cost as little as $4 at a market there, and could sell for as much as $40. So that's the price differential that makes a long drive so alluring.
We did have these industry leaders, stockmen, as they were called. They were able to get wealthy off here in Texas.
Yes, some of them absolutely became wealthy, and this is one of the sources of wealth in Texas after the Civil War. Some of the stockmen became bankers. You know, this is the nest egg for further enterprise.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a-plowing through the ragged skies and up a cloudy draw. Stirred in the sky, their brands were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming hard and heard their mournful cry. Yippee-yi-yi, yippee-yi-yi. Ghost Riders in...
This is Texas Matters. We're talking with Tim Lehman about his book, Up the Trail, How Texas Cowboys Herded Longhorns and Became an American Icon. The myth of the cowboy, though, I mean, we're talking about that these were scruffy young kids, not qualified for anything else except for sitting in the saddle and eating dust all day. How did they become, in America's, in our folklore, the Knights of the Prairie?
Yes. In the 1880s, the cattle drives were ending for a variety of reasons. And about the same time, the nation was falling in love with the Wild West. Buffalo Bill's Wild West shows, dime novels, and the cowboys became one of the stock characters in those shows and novels because the cowboy who became that hero was a little bit transformed. For one thing, they usually, in the heroic version, they usually left out the African-American or Mexican-American part of the story. They added more danger and romance. They turned the cowboy into an expert rider, and some had been, but certainly not all. And also, they gave him a gun. His prowess with the gun became part of his calling card for all the heroic versions. And that seemed to really appeal to a nation at that urbanizing, industrializing moment when they looked nostalgically for a pre-industrial folk hero.
So when you say they gave him a gun, I mean, didn't the cowboy on the trail have his trusty six-shooter?
A lot of cowboys did. It's impossible to know how many, but on the trail they didn't use them very much. They were an encumbrance, perhaps a nuisance, and if they actually used them, they risked a stampede. And so a lot of trail bosses required their cowboys to keep their guns in the chuck wagon and used only if they expected trouble. And, of course, they strapped them on when they went to town because that was for fun. So it's a little bit hard to tell because nobody was, you know, counting or giving us a precise number of on this, but it seems that they are, that the use of guns is more common in people's reminiscences and the mythological versions than in the actual work on the trail.
So if you're going to be sitting in the saddle 11 hours a day, having that pig iron on your hip, you're just like, why am I carrying this thing? Let's lighten up.
Right. Let's lighten up. I don't really need it out here. And if it were to go off accidentally, then we've got a stampede, and no one wants that.
To the town of our free, who rode a stranger one fine day. Hardly spoke to folks around him, didn't have too much to say. No one dared to ask his business, no one dared to make a slip. The stranger there among them held a big iron on his hip. Big iron on his hip. It was early in the morning when he rode into the town. He came riding from the south side, slowly looking all around. He's an outlaw, loose and running, came the whisper from each lip. And he's here to do some business with a big iron on his hip. Big iron on his hip. In this town there lived an outlaw.
So a stampede, okay, that's another Western trope. How big of a problem was that?
It could be a major problem. People lost their lives to that. That's one of the flashpoints of danger on the trail, when the monotony is interrupted by the terror of losing one's life. It also, at a minimum, meant that you had to spend the next several days rounding up your cattle and probably not finding quite all of them.
Another Western myth of the cowboy is the singing cowboy. Did they really sing to the cattle to help lull them and keep them from stampeding?
Again, that probably happened some, although exactly how much is not known. There's no suggestion that the cowboys were especially good at. They probably sang a lot of hymns, actually. But they also made up some songs along the way, trail songs, and then people like John Lomax wrote them down and were very intrigued by that. And so that, too, became a part of the idea of this nostalgic folk hero.
But Hollywood also got hold of the singing cowboy, and soon we had Gene Autry.
Yeah, Gene Autry and Roy Rogers. And, you know, there's a great tradition here, because now we have the cowboy outlaw country singers who, you know, mamas don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys, who play on the bad boy image of the cowboy. And so it's a fun and rich tradition. It's not clear how much of that was invented after the fact, though.
Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars and drive them old trucks. Make them be doctors and lawyers and such. Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. They'll never stay home and they're always alone, even with someone they love. Cowboys ain't easy to love and they're harder to hold. And they'd rather give you a song. Diamonds and gold. Long star belt buckles and old faded Levi's. And each night begins a new day. And if you don't understand him and he don't die young, he'll probably just ride away. Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys.
Why did America need to invent the myth of the cowboy when we had a pretty good story right there?
I think that's a great question, and I think it has to do with the fact that as the country was, in a sense, closing up at the end of the 19th century, there's this cultural moment when people were looking to the past, looking to the frontier for the source of American values and American virtue. And this mythological cowboy, at least, if not the real one, filled the bill quite nicely. People like Theodore Roosevelt helped a lot, too. I mean, he thought cowboys were manly and virtuous. And so it fits in with that notion that in order to be truly American, we needed to protect some of that wild nature and wild spirit.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt was also a cowboy himself in the Dakotas, where he was for a while in a failed cattle venture. He served as a deputy lawman and brought outlaws to justice.
Right.
And he loved to write about it.
Yes, he loved to write about it. And, of course, when he became president, somewhat accidentally through the assassination of the
McKinley.
The president while he was vice president, the comment was, now that damned cowboy is president. And
that wasn't the last time that was said.
Of course, that was, it was only 20 years before that when the president was calling the cowboys ruffians and desperados and violent men on the edges and fringes of proper society.
The myth of the cowboy, we still have people out there, riding horses, and cattle is still a big part of the Texas economy. People still love to eat beef. But now, how are we with that?
I think the myth is strong and interesting. I think it maybe serves some purposes, but it needs to be made real, and it needs to be more inclusive than it sometimes is.
I mean, we have things like every year we have the big rodeo. We talk about how we're celebrating our Western heritage, but are we really, or are we celebrating the Western myth?
Well, it's a myth that's maybe in some ways become real, but it certainly, to the extent that it pretends to be an actual cattle drive, is more mythological than actual.
So, but if we were to talk about the rodeo, celebrating the reality of the cowboy and the cattle industry, then it should be more inclusive and talk about the diversity of the cowboys.
Yeah, I think the diversity of the labor force, really, if you want to think of it that way, and the gritty toughness of the experience. You know, it's worth remembering that most people who went up the trail did it only once. Only a few wanted to repeat that experience.
And that was because it was so hard?
Because it was so hard, so difficult, and frankly, according to lots of the stories, so boring.
Oh, okay, they don't have the shootouts and the damsels and all those other things?
Yeah, the shootouts and the damsels are the invention of the dime novelists, not the experience on the trail.
As I was walking one morning for pleasure, spied a cowpuncher all riding alone. His hat was thrown back and his spurs were jingling, and as he approached he was singing this song. Whoopie-tie-i-o, get along, little dogies, it's your misfortune and none of my own. Whoopie-tie-i-o, get along, little dogies, you know that Wyoming will be your new home.
Tim Lehman is a professor of history at Rocky Mountain College and is the author of Up the Trail, How Texas Cowboys Herded Longhorns and Became an American Icon. It's published by John Hopkins University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org, and that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you download those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.